Well, already, gang, welcome back to the Gutowski Files, starring Stephen Gutowski. He is the founder of TheReload.com and the host of the weekly Reload podcast. Stephen, how are you, sir?
I'm doing pretty well. Been very busy. The weekend had a lot of news for us to talk about.
Indeed, and heartache for you, but we'll talk about that at the end.
Gosh. We don't need to talk about that part.
Yeah, we don't talk about that at the beginning anymore, the S word. Anyway, so there's a lot going on. It's been a busy week in the firearms world, and for those of us paying attention to the firearms-related news and the Second Amendment-related news. So let's start with California. We talked about last week about this case out of California. There's been a significant development. My question is, I'll let you talk about it, is this now a done deal, or is this just another sort of temporary measure? Tell the folks what's going on out there.
That's a very good question, because what happened was the motions panel was reversed by the merits panel. Now, I know this probably isn't going to make any sense to anybody who isn't a lawyer or very well versed in how the federal court system works, but we talked about earlier how the California's new gun-free zone expansion law, SB2, that sort of effectively banned all gun carry in the state. You know, essentially put in so many of these restricted areas, these sensitive places, that in practice it would be almost impossible to carry your gun. Even if this applies to people with concealed carry permits, it would be practically impossible to carry it on you without running into one of these gun-free zones where, right, if you carry there, you could be charged with a crime. But that rule, that law was found unconstitutional, right? We talked about that. The federal judge said that it was incompatible with the Second Amendment and the Supreme Court's precedent on gun carry that was handed down in the Bruin case, right? And then what's called the motions panel, the state appealed that decision, right? And it went to this thing called the motions panel, where they sort of are a go-between for the actual panel that is going to decide the case at trial, the merits panel. Mm-hmm. And the motions panel granted an administrative stay on this ruling. And this is all, I know that all sounds like legalese, but the practical impact of that was very big, because what it meant was the law, which had not gone into effect yet when the lower court gave down its ruling, you know, essentially preventing the law from going into effect at all and keeping things as they had been up to that point. But on January 1st, the law was allowed to go into effect. So all these gun-free zones became enforceable at that point because of this stay that had stayed the ruling of the lower court. And that was huge, because California, obviously the largest state in the country, a place where people outside of, you know, more rural areas had only just begun to have the ability to get permits to carry in the first place because, right, of the Bruin rule, because that forced the state to change how it issues permits. And now those people would effectively be back to a place where they aren't allowed to legally carry because of an administrative stay. Now what happened after that was we heard from the merits panel on Saturday. So these things have all, you know, one of the motions was filed on Christmas Eve night. And then now we have this reversal of the stay that was put in place, and that happened on Saturday. So the courts are actually working pretty quickly and at odd times to do this case. So that kind of gives you an insight into how important they think it is. But the practical effect now is that the lower court's ruling is back into effect. This law is unconstitutional, according to that lower court, and can't be enforced as the appeals move forward. Now, it could, as you sort of alluded to here, there is a possibility that it could be reversed again, and they might issue some kind of stay that came from the order itself, said that, you know, this is pending, future decisions from the panel. That's would be, I think it's unlikely that you're going to see it get reversed and reversed, have the stay go back into effect.
Double secrecy reversed.
Yeah, there's just so much legal whiplash going on over this that I would be surprised if they did anything again until actual oral arguments begin in April. So it does seem like for the next couple of months, at least, this, you're going to keep that status quo, because the status quo in this situation was not having this law in place. Like that, the lower court judge ruled before the law went into effect. So all his ruling really does is keep things as they were. So these, right, these sorts of expanded gun-free zones weren't around before January 1st. And so after being placed for about a week, they're back off the table. And we also might see this case get combined with some other ones. There's a case out of Hawaii where there was a similar lower court ruling that blocked most of the sensitive places restrictions that Hawaii had put into place, these sort of gun-free zones. And so that's also scheduled for April, and it would be pretty surprising if, and that's also in the Ninth Circuit, which is where this California case is, would be pretty surprising if they didn't get combined into one case, but that hasn't officially happened yet. But that seems to be the direction things are headed. And yeah, pretty significant, though technical, rulings going on here.
Indeed. So folks who are listening in California, please do not take this show as any kind of legal advice. Terms and conditions may apply, all rights reserved. Make sure you check your, you know, the actual situation on the ground there before you carry or don't carry or make a decision. Because as you've seen, as you heard from what Stephen had to say, it's it changes rather frequently, unfortunately. Hopefully will stay the status quo until the actual trial begins.
You got to keep up to date with all this stuff, because that's another thing that could absolutely happen. This is not a final ruling. None of this is a final ruling. The judge blocked the law, the lower court judge, on a preliminary injunction basis, which is before the actual technical merits of a trial happen. Now, to get that ruling, the judge has to find that the plaintiffs are likely to succeed on the merits. So it's why often it can be kind of confusing to listen to this stuff, because it's very, you know, if a judge rules you're likely to succeed on the merits, then he's probably going to rule that you did succeed on the merits once the case gets to that point. But it's not actually at that point yet. This comes into place usually more so with like Freedom Week kind of stuff. If people remember, some people are familiar with that term. That was, for instance, there was a preliminary injunction issued against California's magazine ban at one point that was not stayed. And so there was about a week where people could legally buy magazines that were over the limit that California has, or I should say, where enforcement of that law was blocked. But then a higher court got rid of that enforcement. And so in theory, you could still be prosecuted if you bought during that time, once the law goes back into effect, if that makes sense. That could happen here as well. If the higher court eventually strikes down this preliminary injunction, even during that time where it was in place, where enforcement was blocked, law enforcement could go back and charge you. Now, I don't think it's super common to see that happen, but it is a potential risk. You know, this, so, you know, just be informed, I guess, when you go out. This law still exists. It's just not being enforced at the moment is really the practical implications of all this.
Right. So, Stephen, I've been paying attention to the news. Is there anything else going on in the Second Amendment world, gun-related stuff, anything happened in the last week, what do you think?
I don't know. There was a guy who resigned. I don't know if we want to talk about that.
Oh, yeah. Pierre LaWayne or something. I can't remember his name. Yes. NRA guy, I want to say. He's been around for a few years. Anyway.
Yeah, I think he spent some time at the NRA.
Everyone already knows that happened. I think what they don't know, honestly, or they may not know, is some of the implications. And you wrote a member exclusive over at thereload.com entitled Analysis: Wayne LaPierre's Resignation Changes Nothing and Everything for the NRA. So what did you mean by that?
Yeah, well, people might not even know about this, actually, because you know, they announced his resignation on Friday. It was a sort of a Friday news dump. That's a common thing as somebody who's been a reporter for a long time. If somebody has news they want to share that they don't want to get as much attention to, Friday is the day that they put out that news. And so Friday also happened to be the last day before the New York corruption trial for the NRA began, because today, Monday, as we're filming, is the day that the trial started. So, you know, Wayne, one of the reasons he gave was health related, and he is, you know, getting up there in age. I think he's 74, and he has had some health issues that were apparent during the bankruptcy trial. So I, you know, that may well be part of the calculation here, but also it's hard to ignore, of course, the timing related to this corruption trial, which he's at the center of. And the reason that I say nothing changes because of his resignation is, for, well, a couple of reasons. One, the resignation actually doesn't go in. This is something I think maybe people don't realize as well, but it doesn't actually go into effect until the end of the month. So as of today, Wayne LaPierre is still the executive vice president of the NRA. And that means he will be through much of this trial because the trial is expected to last for about 6 weeks. So how much of an impact it has on the jury's view of whether the NRA has changed or not, I think, you know, remains to be seen, especially since, again, he's still going to be EVP for most of this trial period. And then, of course, once he does actually leave, the person who's taking over is a guy named Andrew Arulanandam, who has long been one of Wayne's top confidants. He was, has been the spokesperson at the NRA for quite a long time now. And he was actually the spokesperson up until last month when they suddenly fired the head of general operations, which is the part of the NRA that handles kind of the really popular stuff, you know, the gun safety training, the competitive shooting, all that, that aspect of the nonprofit,
sort of the non-legislative of the side of things, right?
More or less. Yes, right. Yeah. Exactly. The stuff that's not political advocacy or things like that, but the NRA does a lot of things, not just political advocacy. It also is the largest, you know, gun safety training organization in the world. And so the person who ran that part of the NRA was let go and replaced by Arulanandam. And it just so happens to be that the person in that position fills the role of the executive vice president should the executive vice president step down. So there's obviously some maneuvering going on there. Same thing happened with the NRA president. Charles Cotton is the current president, and he was supposed to be out of that position. His term was supposed to be up last year. And the same sort of thing happened. The person who was slated to replace him was really kind of unceremoniously tossed out of his officer role. The NRA has this whole succession thing where you're president, then that person leaves and they're filled by the person who was the first vice president. And then they have a second vice president. And these are all kind of more fundraising roles at the NRA. They don't have as much power as what Wayne does in the executive vice president role. Mm-hmm. I know that all sounds confusing, but that's how it works. And the guy who was in line to become president, a guy named Willis Lee, he got pushed out earlier this year, and they actually had to change the bylaws of the organization to make an exception for Charles Cotton to keep him as president. And Charles Cotton is another person who is a very staunch Wayne ally, and who has been one of the people with a tremendous amount of control over the NRA for the last several years. So, you know, these are guys who also have been very much on board with and have defended the legal strategy that outside lawyer Bill Brewer has put in place for the NRA over these last 5 years or so. And so it's very unlikely that really anything is going to change in the short term because those guys are going to be in control.
So my next question was, you know, for the NRA member that's listening, and I'm sure a lot of our audience is probably NRA members. Should they have any hope that this means anything will change in the executive board? Could you really quick explain for the listeners and the viewers the difference between the board and the executive board and kind of how it works as far as who elects who to become, you know, senior members of leadership?
Yeah, certainly. Well, there's a lot to dig into here, but I'll try to keep it relatively simple. Sure. First off, you know, like I just laid out, it doesn't change anything in the near term, Wayne resigning. But I think it changes everything in the long term, because a lot of the reason from my outside looking in sort of view, and I've covered the NRA for years now, I've been to a lot of their board meetings and every one of their annual meetings for the last, you know, good while. And a lot of the reluctance to change things on the board, I think, comes from a loyalty to Wayne himself, because people and frankly, rightfully, look at Wayne's track record and the history of the NRA under his leadership and think he has done a lot. He's accomplished quite a lot. And the NRA has grown quite powerful under his leadership. And so they kind of think, well, if Wayne is on board with this plan, then it'll probably pay off in the end, like it has in other situations previously. And so with Wayne gone, Wayne not being the one that you have to vote for or against in an election for EVP, I think that changes everything as far as the dynamics. But the earliest, unless the board takes emergency action, which seems unlikely to happen because they didn't do any, this resignation announcement came as they were finishing up their most recent board meeting down in Dallas. Mm-hmm. Unless they bring together an emergency meeting between now and May, the next time they're going to even get together is going to be in May, which is going to be well after this trial is over. And the trial has a much more significant likelihood to actually impact the NRA in the short term and force out some of these leadership, these people in leadership, and actually even have a court appointed overseer come in and sort of take control of how the NRA operates. But if that doesn't happen, or they appeal, or, you know, it gets gummed up in the legal system, which can absolutely happen in theory, right? You still are likely to see a change in direction. And I mean, you know, we just don't know who would take over in Wayne's absence. I don't know that Andrew Rulinundum is going to be there long-term as the board's, you know, approved executive vice president moving forward, even with Wayne sort of putting him in that position to become EVP temporarily. You know, they still have to decide on whether that's going to be the permanent future for them.
Right.
But whoever it is going to be a different person than Wayne and is going to have different priorities, at least to some degree. They might not be wildly different, but they could be. I don't know. You know, it's hard to say, especially since they've, over the last couple of years, the internal fight has really hollowed out a lot of the people that would have been in, you know, thought of as in line. Like Chris Cox, for instance, was the head of the Institute for Legislative Action, which is their political arm, and was sort of the other big face you'd see at the annual meeting. They put the big posters of people up around the leadership. You know, you get Wayne and Chris, and when Dana Lash was a spokesperson, she had her giant face all over the place. And none of those people are left now. Oliver North was there one time when he was president, but none of those guys are left. So it's a real crapshoot as to what's going to happen from there. Of course, that's the other part of it too, is the NRA board, as you alluded to here, it's a pretty fascinating thing to try and look at and understand from the outside. Or even if you're like an NRA member, even if you're an NRA voting member, because this is another thing, like NRA members, you could buy an NRA membership tomorrow and not actually be able to vote in any of the leadership elections,
right?
The board member elections, because you have to be either a lifetime member or a member for 5 consecutive years to get a vote outside of, they actually have a sort of a loophole that for this, whereas anybody who shows up at the annual meeting can vote, regardless of their, as long as they're a member, because you're actually under New York law, you're required to let all of your members vote in leadership or board elections. And so that's how they satisfy that. But that means probably about half of NRA membership, last time I ran the numbers at least, can't vote in their elections, by at least not through any other mechanism but the where you show up at the annual meeting and do it in person.
Can I assume that the reason for that, and it kind of makes sense, is, you know, if a group that was not favorable to people owning guns wanted to get together and have a bunch of people sign up to become NRA members tomorrow, they could just then vote however. And, you know, they don't. So I'm thinking that the 5-year requirement is for that reason, or is that, am I wrong?
That's one of the stated reasons. But I mean, a side effect of this is that it makes it much harder for new members to have any influence over the NRA at all.
Right.
So yes, that, but I will say that that is absolutely something that they have put up as a reason for why that requirement exists. And also, I mean, that's the reason given for a lot of things that they do. Like oftentimes the board will go into executive session to avoid things that they're saying becoming public, because it's, this is this, there's a lot of paranoia around, you know, Michael Bloomberg or somebody like that undermining the organization. And it's used oftentimes to justify a lot of the sort of secrecy and, closeting off of the NRA's, you know, member influence on its own operations. And I mean, that's part of why this sort of corruption was able to persist for so long and get so out of hand. You know, whether how much you, how far you think it goes, obviously there's some dispute. The NRA disputes quite a lot of the accusations, but they have admitted to, even Wayne himself has been forced to admit that he did take excess benefits, that even things like, he was forced to pay back the NRA for private flights that his family members took that he wasn't even on that were billed to the NRA, or his hairdresser. I think his wife's hairdresser was also flown around on private jets paid for by the NRA. You know what I mean? Like, it's much easier to pull off that kind of stuff when your organization is, much more difficult to influence from the membership level.
If there ever is a corruption scandal at Active Self Protection, it will not involve my hairdresser. I just want to state that now unequivocally. There will be no hairdresser for Mike Williver flying around on private jets.
You don't fly someone in to take care of that beard?
Believe it or not, I do it myself. This is the result of literally minutes of grooming.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to go for the longer hair look, and I feel like I'm still in the in-between stages of that, which is so thank you, Wayne, for resigning at this moment when I was trying to grow my hair out, and now I have to be on TV a bunch.
Yep.
But either way, you know, it's and the board itself is sort of difficult to, by design, I think, to enact change through. I mean, there's 76 board members, for people who don't know that. And actually only one of those board members is elected at the board meeting through that mechanism I mentioned earlier. But, you know, the real people, that means you have a lot of people, and most of them aren't actually in positions of power on the NRA board. The positions of power are held by people like Charles Cotton, who has been the head of a number of very important committees. For instance, the nominating committee, which is the committee that decides whether or not you get on the ballot to become an NRA board member. There's only two ways on the ballot. There's, you can be picked by the board itself, which I think we can all see why that might lead to issues, or you can run by petition. And there's only ever been, I think, one or two people per term that get on by petition. There are actually four running right now on the ballot, by petition, because the threshold to get on is determined by how many people actually voted in the election, and the number of people voting in NRA board member elections has been declining for a long time now. And I believe reached all time, you know, reached a decade low last election. So it was easier for some of these, more, dissident members, some of former board members, Phil Journey and, Rocky Marshall, mm-hmm. would be some of the board members who have tried to run against Wayne in the past, are on the ballot this time around. And so you might actually see some of them end up back on the board by May. But you know, that's one of the things, you mentioned, you asked a little bit earlier, and maybe I've gotten too into the weeds on how the NRA works here. You can kind of get an idea of that. It's not very straightforward. It's a very
it's a lot to cover.
Complex. Yeah. It's a very complex organization, with a lot of bylaws that are kind of hard to follow and understand completely from the outside, for sure, and perhaps even from the inside. But the way that somebody becomes the executive vice president or one of these other vice president positions, or basically an officer, is that they put up a slate at the board meetings for approval by the board. And there've been a lot of criticism of this in the past. I remember Alan West was a board member who was became sort of a dissident and opposed to Wayne LaPierre, actually ran against him at one point for executive vice president. Right. But I remember he complained in the 2019 meeting that this is the one where Oliver North was, left, and there was a whole blow up at the members meeting, and the allegations of corruption had came out at that meeting. And Alan West had complained that when they went to vote on whether Wayne should be kept as executive vice president, they did it by acclamation, essentially, that by a voice vote, like that there was a single slate of officers put up by the nominating committee. So the nominating committee decides who gets to run or who gets on the ballot to run for the board. Right. And then they also decide who gets put up to be voted up or down for officer positions. And Alan West didn't like this because basically the board members got no choice in who to vote for. They could just vote yes or no. And if it failed, then I suppose they would have gone to more votes after that. But I think really the first time anyone's ever run against Wayne LaPierre was only just recently. I think maybe 2 years ago was the first time somebody was put up to run against him in that position. So, this internal governance there, the board is, there's some issues with it. I would say that's perhaps more my judgment of it, but people can make their own judgment.
I think that's safe to say. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that's probably safe to say. So I don't know if you want to, digress into sports talk or not. I certainly don't.
I'm okay with never talking about the Eagles ever again.
The only thing I can talk about with my beloved Commanders is we have a great draft pick, but that's always so hollow. Like the idea that, this draft pick, this QB or this, this left tackle or whatever is going to have somehow save the team. No, there's a lot more than one position to save this team. And hopefully our new ownership group, Josh Harris, I think his name is, and Magic Johnson, all those guys.
Yeah, he owns the Sixers, weirdly.
Yeah, Ron Rivera is gone. I think Ron Rivera tried. I really do. I think most of his time was spent sort of managing the public image under Snyder, which wasn't good. And so he's kind of given an impossible task. But hopefully the next guy, the next GM and head coach can make something happen. But that's all
this
I got to
say. This is the thing about sports that – this is why it was so hard when the Eagles and Phillies both lost the championship games last year, because I think people really underestimate how difficult it is to even get to that position.
It's right? Incredibly.
Like this year, looking at it, when we were going into this season for the Eagles and actually also for the Phillies, they looked like better teams on paper, like talent wise. It's like, okay, these teams, they actually seem like maybe they've improved at least a little bit. And to be the Phillies, look, the Eagles are in the playoffs. Anything can happen in the playoffs. They sure don't look like a team who's going to beat a playoff team
right
after the last couple of weeks. But I don't know. You never know. but yeah, and the Phillies made it back to the NLCS, but then they blew a 2-0, lead in that series. And that's just like, it's so hard to even get just a winning culture in a sports team. That's what I notice when I look around at sports teams. Like it's hard to get a winning culture. That's like Mike Tomlin, right? He hasn't won a Super Bowl since what, 2010 or something like that, right? But they made he's been over 500 like every single season, hasn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And they just made the playoffs with a team that I think nobody thinks is that super talented. And, I'm sure there's some consternation there after a while of being over 500, but not winning the Super Bowl for 15 years or whatever. And there's just sort of we had this with Andy Reid in Philly, right? Like, he had this culture of winning, and we kept winning, and we kept getting the NFC Championship, and we made it to one Super Bowl, but we never won a Super Bowl with him. And eventually people want to move on. And, he went to Kansas City, and what has he done there since he left?
Just
wins all the time. And so it's, you know, that's the thing about it. It's like, you got to really appreciate when you have a winning culture. And if you can't, and if you, in those moments when you get to the top and you don't win, to me, it's, that's where I start to worry, because it's like, oh, it's so hard just to get there. And just barely not being able to pull it off is, I don't know if it's better or worse. It's still better, I guess, because you get the ride along the way, but.
How hard must it be for all the young Patriots fans who've known nothing but championships and championship runs spoiled. Their entire young lives?
Like, I mean, you can even have a brilliant coach.
With the Redskins.
Look at the Patriots. Yeah, you can have a brilliant coach. You can get a bunch of high draft picks, and you can still not put it together.
Yep,
that's just the way of it. Like if your team is on a run, if your team wins a championship, you better enjoy that, because there is no guarantee that's going to continue.
Take a picture, buy the t-shirt, because it may never happen again. There's still people I know that are fans of teams that have never been to a Super Bowl or never, certainly never won a ring. And that's gotta be tough. What Super Bowl are we up to now? 137? What number are we on? It's high.
Yeah, 50 something, right?
Yeah, it's 58 or something like that. Anyway. All right. Well, that is our time. We have gone over our normal time, which is fine. Hopefully you're still listening. If you are, do me two favors. One, rate and review this show on Apple Podcast or Spotify. Those ratings and reviews make a difference, and they draw people to the show, whether you like the Gutowski Files or the regular show or both. It really does help us out. And also, go over to thereload.com and consider getting a membership. Steven does rely on his membership dues to fund his important work. He's doing work nobody else is doing, and we appreciate you, Steven. And sir, as always, you have the last word.
Absolutely.